Hello, compost lovers, and welcome back to episode 3 of season 4 of The Composter. I'm so glad you're here. This season has been all about hearing from experienced composters doing innovative and impactful work, and today's episode is no exception. Last fall, I had the chance to visit Rust Belt Riders in Cleveland, Ohio during the Community Composters Coalition meetup. It was one of the most memorable composting experiences I've had, because it was a big group of young, passionate community composters. We toured the Rust Belt Riders Collection headquarters, where they had beer and kombucha on tap, shared an amazing taco dinner with local fish baked right in a thermophilic compost pile. Yes, really, it was delicious. And during that trip on a bus ride out to visit Earth and Woods compost site, Nathan Rutz gave us a guided tour of the city, weaving together compost and Cleveland's rich, complex history with a depth of knowledge that left a lasting impression. Today, I'm thrilled to share my conversation with Nathan. He's the director of soil and a longtime force behind Rust Belt Riders, a composting operation that's grown from bicycles and buckets to launching a mid-scale compost facility right in the center of Cleveland. Their story is truly inspiring, not just because of the growth, but because of how intentionally they've done it. We talk about the early days and what it's been like to scale, the importance of their unique cooperative business structure, which sets them apart in the composting world. And toward the end of the conversation, Nathan shares his beautiful vision of a compost-centric utopian future. It's heartfelt, imaginative, and honestly something we could all use a bit more of. I'm so excited for you to hear this one. Let's jump into my conversation with Nathan Rutz of Rust Belt Riders. This episode is brought to you by AgriLab Technologies. Visit them at agrilabtech.com/podcast and Green Mountain Technologies at compostingtechnology.com. Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for compost lovers. Gravity rings around Saturn and Mike. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner. Through real conversations with composters and industry professionals, we are digging deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production. Whether you're managing a large-scale site or just compost curious, this podcast is here to inform, inspire, and connect us all as part of a growing movement to enliven the world's soils. This summer, I visited Vermont Natural Ag Products, the home of Mudu Compost. One thing that really stood out was an innovative system from AgriLab Technologies that both speeds the compost process using aeration and captures thermal heat from the compost to warm the Mudu bagging barn. Ingenious. I reached out to Brian at AgriLab Technologies afterwards, and I'm thrilled to share that they now generously sponsor this podcast. AgriLab Technologies provides solutions for efficient composting. Their team works with farmers, commercial, institutional, and municipal composters to save energy, labor, and space on your site. Their modular compost aeration equipment and technical support services improves process control, making better compost faster with less odor and impact. They can also capture renewable thermal energy from composting to heat nearby buildings, wash water, and for drying finished compost. Build your soil and burn less oil. Reach out to AgriLab Technologies today. Visit us at agrilabtech.com/podcast. Green Mountain Technologies has been a leading composting technology firm since 1992. Our clients cover the spectrum of small farms, institutions, and resorts, along with the largest composting facilities in North America. From our Earthflow composter to ASP Technologies and compost turners, we offer solutions for every commercial composting opportunity. Visit compostingtechnology.com and mention the Composter Podcast for a free consultation. Nathan, welcome to The Composter. I'm so psyched to have you on today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get started with the origin story. Tell us all about Rust Belt Riders, where you're based, and how it all began.
Started on bicycles in 2014. It was a year when it seemed there must have been something going around in the air. Maybe there was a microbe. Maybe we got some like very positive version of cordyceps. Was there a compost cordyceps floating around? It caused people to start like creeping around looking for food scraps. I live in Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland, Ohio is a Rust Belt city, meaning that we used to have a whole bunch of heavy industry, and there still is some around. But deindustrialization has been aggressive. But that also means that there's a lot of contamination around from those heavy industries, particularly pre-1970s, when there were a whole lot of environmental regulations passed. So we have highly contaminated place. You know, we're famously the home of the Burning River, which apparently one of the reasons that got popularized was because the issue of Time magazine that covered the Kennedy assassination also featured photos of the Cuyahoga River on fire. That's a story I've heard. So we're in this city that has, it's also highly depopulated. So at its peak, Cleveland had just under 1 million people. Now we have just over 300,000 people.
Wow.
So it's precipitous depopulation. Where's everybody going? Some of it's to suburbs, but overall, Ohio exports a lot of people. So there's tons of Ohioans all over the country. And anyway, the folks that ended up starting Rust Belt Writers, being in our mid-20s at that time and infected with the compost cordyceps, I was working at an environmental nonprofit, and I got into all of this because of a strong sense of dedicating my life to environmental justice because of encountering mountaintop removal coal mining when I was in college, and mountaintop removal coal mining's where coal companies blow up mountains in Appalachia for the sake of mildly cheaper coal, which is a whole horrible ball of wax, destroying the world faster with more emissions, etc. Let's power those data centers. I was working at an environmental nonprofit, and I bought a house close to downtown that I could afford, because that can happen in the city of Cleveland. It had high lead in the soil in the backyard, so I got a soil test because I wanted to garden and I was interested in permaculture and all those fun things, and I'd taken a 72-hour PDC class when I was 22 or something in Cincinnati. So I got the soil test done. I bought some so-called topsoil, and it's full of clay and trash. Pretty disappointed with that, so I started picking up coffee grounds on my bike. Started making really bad compost by piling up coffee grounds because I was like, oh, I was reading in my books, like, okay, you know, you got your carbon and nitrogen ratios. Paper's got a super high carbon nitrogen ratio. Like, oh, filters. There's coffee filters in here. Surely this is enough because the CN ratio is so wide. It wasn't. And I made really bad compost for about 6 months. And then meanwhile, at the same time, Michael and Dan, who started the LLC Rust Belt Writers Composting, we're working at a farm-to-table restaurant and experiencing all the cool stuff there and seeing all the food waste coming out of even a really pretty high-end farm-to-table restaurant. So they started thinking about food scraps and those going in the landfill. And also at the time, you might remember there was a several-year span when the USDA was handing out high tunnels to everybody.
Yep, I got one.
Yeah, nice. Lots of people got high tunnels in Cleveland. Unfortunately, many of them were abandoned pretty quickly, but they were all over the place. And the idea of urban farming, community gardening was on the rise at that moment. And there was this connection of ideas like, look, we have all these food scraps. We have these community gardens whose soil isn't very good. Can we take two bads and make it a good with food scraps and compost and community gardens? And hey, why don't we do it in the most decentralized possible way where we bicycle food scraps to these community gardens, whether the scraps be made into compost. Unfortunately, the compost was never really made. Most community gardens, the people want to just garden, and you have to have a really well-organized volunteer group to have somebody managing composting on a community garden scale as well. Or we have just like much more robust community gardening culture, which we don't have. And so the composting didn't really happen. It became anaerobic sludge at a lot of the sites. And so most of the community gardens didn't actually end up wanting a lot of food scraps. But that was that magical moment in 2014 when I was picking up coffee grounds by bicycle independently while Rust Belt Writers Composting LLC started picking up food scraps from a couple of residents and coffee shops and restaurants on the near west side of Cleveland. And that came together in 2017 when I joined the team. And then we really started making compost in a bigger way because in that span of time, I got somewhat obsessed with compost, and then gotten into starting to listen to podcasts all the time. And I'd heard a really great explanation of like what is going on in soil and how plants eat, a description of the soil food web from Dr. Lane Ingham. And so I was like, wow, this is cool. This is the first time I've heard an explanation of composting that makes sense to me. So then I looked it up and I got a job at a different nonprofit, and suddenly I was like, oh man, I'm like less low income. I guess I could afford to take these classes now. So I took the online compost classes and was just furiously obsessed with composting at that point.
2017?
So that would be 2015 into 16, okay. I made dozens of hand-turned piles at a small nonprofit in Cleveland called Cleveland Roots. Michael and Dan and Jesse were dropping off food scraps to me, and I was making these pallet piles and looking at them under the microscope. And then I started just like listening to every podcast and trying to like get a hold of people. Anybody I'd heard of that was doing interesting compost work, I would call them. And this was before Jesse Frost had started the No-Till Growers Show. And so I was listening to the Farmer to Farmer with Chris Blanchard. And so that's how I heard about Vermont Compost and Dr. John Birnbaum, formerly of Michigan State. And I got a hold of them and started chatting them up, just diving into how composting works and thinking about all the amazing things compost can do and just being sort of bewildered by here, built into nature is this way of sanitation. Built into nature is this way we can take the bad and make it into the good. And so for me, that was also very potent spiritually, because as a religious person myself, I've been a member of an Episcopal church for about 14 years. Forgiveness of sins built into creation in the form of composting. So here we have this physical version of that happening all around us, or it's possible for that to be happening constantly. And so we can participate in that cycle of the ecological cycle of resurrection all the time and see it happen. It's like, whoa. And the microbes to do it are floating around everywhere. You don't have to have a special inoculum. What are the thermophilic microbes doing in this room right now? Why are they here? How are they surviving? But they're floating around all over the place on everything, just ready for action. Should a human assemble those conditions?
The passion, the curiosity, your bravery too is like really shining through in starting all of this and keeping it going. And it seems like you felt like you didn't have a
naivete.
Choice. Yeah, totally. I love that. And I think you learned so many valuable lessons in learning about making really poor quality compost. You learned so much about a good quality compost. So it's a valuable experience that you have there. So you guys are in the process of expanding. Walk us through what that journey has looked like from bicycles and picking up the food scraps and working with community gardens to now and what's happening.
Well, we started on bicycles, pretty quickly moved into a pickup truck, and then moved to a cargo van, and then added a lift gate to the cargo van, and then started using rolling carts or toters instead of picking up 18-gallon totes all the time. Where we are today is looking toward the future. This year, we expect to pick up about 4,500 tons of food, which is not a humongous amount, but it is quite substantial given where we've come from and the fact that we are in a low tipping fee state. Ohio is a low trash tipping fee state, which is something I like talking about. So it's hard to compete on price. So far, everybody that we pick up from is doing it because they want to, not because there's a financial incentive to do so. So we have to try to figure out how to make it cheaper. We want to have a positive impact on the greater Cleveland area's ecology. I think there's a sense of scale. We want to be deep locally, not huge all over the place. We don't want to be in a bunch of other cities in Ohio. We want to be strong here. We are part of the Community Composting Coalition, which is organized through the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Wonderful folks, been on the show. But I like to think of potentially the dream is like, can the community composters and other composters too, that aren't necessarily part of that, be part of a mycorrhizal network, a mycorrhizal economics of like, yes, we are a tree here. We don't have to be an organism that's like trying to eat the whole world. In fact, I think if we want to practice biomimicry, if we look at nature and we think about biomimicry, the massive corporation is actually not very well represented in organisms. And so we sure are on a precarious trajectory as a species. We sure are, as a species, doing a bunch of crazy stuff that seems to be undermining the very possibility of life on Earth as we have enjoyed it so far, and being desperately in love with the world as we all hope to be, and like, you know, seeing dappled sunlight on a cloud and a child's face and a bird, like, whoa.
I get the same
what
feelings.
Else can you, what do we do that can be appropriate? And how do we try to not accidentally do evil things? One of the ideas that I think I perceive from thinking about ecology and the way that organisms in general are organized is that there's a limited scale. So our sense of like how big and no more. An important book in my life is this collection of essays by Wendell Berry called Art of the Commonplace. And there's one of the, I think it's in The Unsettling of America, where he says, no further, this is the place. So if we're thinking about no further, this is the place, we're going to take care of this part of our world. So anyway, lots of preamble to saying, we decided to set a goal, an ambitious goal of getting to 20,000 tons a year by 2030. So that'll require lots of changes in our operational model, which is good. because beyond 20,000 tons is about 10% of the food scraps landfilled. No, it's actually a little bit less than 10% of the food scraps landfilled from the greater Cleveland area. So it's about 300,000 tons of food a year get landfilled from our metropolitan area. So something I've been saying out loud, which hasn't been adopted as official policy by Rust Belt writers, but can we get to 200,000 tons of food diverted a year? Sure, we're going to account for population change or whatever when all the Californians start moving to Cleveland because of climate change. By the time I'm ready to be composted, can we have it be the norm that most food is well-respected? Most nutrients are well-respected? Boy, that would be cool. So the level of thinking is like, we want to be holding hands with others in other parts of the world, other parts of the state and country. And we want, and we also don't expect to be the only ones in town. This town is definitely big enough for other people too. I do think of ourselves as sort of the charismatic megafauna of the composting work in Northeast Ohio, because we're visible and people see us. But not everybody needs to be the elephant. So we are headed toward increasing our capacity. So that means moving away from box trucks, because box trucks, it's really hard to make a middle-class wage using box trucks and swapping toters. If you can help it, if you can find cheap money, which is hard to do, to borrow to get trucks that can enable you to be much more efficient, like tipper trucks, that's where we're headed now, is more tippers, more dumping, more like dump trucks, not tipping carts individually. We are working on, there's a friend of the business is opening a composting facility on the west side of town, which is really exciting. And that'll be like a 15,000 ton a year site. Our site in the city of Cleveland is going to be like a 5,000 to 7,000 ton a year site. And that's really exciting too. It's been really important to us to do some serious scale composting in city limits. And of course, we seem to always choose to do things on hard mode. That's important to us because we're in such a depopulated city that so many people have chosen to leave, and to say no further, this is the place, is really important to us collectively. And the site is also a 6-acre industrial parcel that's been vacant for about 50 years. And the last thing it was a landfill transfer station.
Okay, 60 acres or 16?
Six.
Six.
A mere 6 acres.
Oh, okay. Not 60 or 16. Six.
Nope.
Cool.
Six.
Cool. All right. And how did the meetings go with the town in the last couple weeks, or the city?
Yeah, the city said, yes, we're going to sell you this property.
All right. That's so great. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. That's exciting. So a little hub right there in downtown Cleveland. I love that.
Yep.
Okay. So when I visited the warehouse last fall, which was really fun, I had a blast, I was really struck by the cooperative model. I actually haven't seen that in other compost operations. It's so different from the usual top-down structure that I'm accustomed to. Can you tell us about that and how it works? What are the pros and cons, and how did you even come to that?
Well, it was a very early idea for Rust Belt Writers that we wanted to be a co-op, because we needed to recycle our nutrients and be competent, having the ability to do so, the infrastructure to do so. It's also important that we think that top-down management is more likely to lead to the sorts of anti-ecological behavior that we see from so-called normal corporations. And when you have more voices that are given more equal weight, you are more likely to make decisions that are better, I think, hopefully. And better how? Hard to measure. The dream of the co-op is that every person is brilliant in unique ways. That's a foundational assumption. And hopefully that in a co-op setting, and I wouldn't say we've achieved this in its most glorious form yet, is that you get so many good ideas. You have like virtuous cycles of changes and ideas into each other that you are more able to incorporate the unique brilliance of each person into the work and insights into the work in a way that is less possible in a top-down approach. So we were legally a two-person LLC for many years. We incorporated into a co-op in December 2021. Legally, and after 2,000 hours of full-time work, which is not that much really, you are eligible to become a worker owner. And then worker owners vote on the board. It doesn't have to be composed of worker owners, but worker owners are the ones that vote for board seats. And then the board is the governance body, which then sort of selects how the management structure is going to happen. And we have a management structure that is unique-ish to ourselves, but it is adapted from a management structure called CoLab, which comes from an organization called Round Sky Solutions. Our work is organized into essentially departments, or we call them scopes of work. And there are elected positions within each of those scopes of work, and there's elected positions in the whole organization. So it's sort of like a cell with organelles in it, and there's information going this way and that way all the time.
How many are in the cooperative total right now?
We have like 35 employees right now total.
Okay.
And there's 14 worker owners. We have about, I think, 4 or 5 people eligible for worker ownership at the moment.
Do most people choose that then? Like when they finish their 2,000 hours?
So far.
Okay.
Yeah.
So interesting. Yeah. Okay. I'm digging it.
We've had times of we want to not spend too much time in meetings. And meetings sure get expensive because we're also hourly.
Yeah.
Because we had this was a whole thing several years ago where like some people were like salaried, but they were working more. And so their hourly rate was ultimately less and all this. So we just went to hourly. Like now you don't go above 40, which is also good. We're playing within boundaries, which can force creativity sometimes.
Yeah. The meetings, I think, are the challenging part. Like I have this feeling like a meeting after 1 hour is no longer productive. And to keep when you have that many people part of it, it's really challenging to rein that in.
Right. Which is why having smaller groups is important.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And having some trust. It's like not everybody is weighing in on every single thing.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So neat. Yeah. I'm so sad to watch co-ops. You know, we used to have a thriving co-op in our town. And I'm so sad to see that's no longer around. And it's like across the country, I'm seeing that happening. Like those co-ops from the 70s are just not working anymore. And so I'm glad to see
like
some
grocery
starting.
Co-ops?
Yeah, grocery co-ops. Yeah, we had just a great one here in our town. Okay, cool. Your group just thinks out of the box all of the time. And I know that you're such a good part of that. I see you as a leader in this compost community. You're so politically active, so community oriented. You see the bigger picture all the time and you're pushing the boundaries. It's really awesome. It's really, really, it's refreshing. It's so refreshing. Where do you see the community composting movement headed? Because you're like at the front of it.
At this point, we're sort of an older sibling in the community composting room. Or an older cousin. I hope that we can get ourselves organized to have a co-op of co-ops potentially. So can we start forming the mycorrhiza? Can we identify, all right, I'm a tree, you're a tree. All right, let's start sharing resources in some kind of way. That's where I'd like to see things happening. If we're serious about doing something about our fool's hope in the face of climate change and biodiversity loss, all the ills, we have to be aggressive about how we move. To some extent. And being aggressive about care is kind of a weird thing to do.
Gently aggressive.
So it's, I don't know the answer to this, but it's something I think and talk about. To get to scale while trying to emulate things that we think are good. I know there's some community composters that have struggled. I mean, we've taken risks. We've taken on debt in some ways that other people haven't been willing to do. And it's risky and it's precarious. But I guess what else are we going to do with our one wild and precious life, right? But I guess I'd hope to see community composters, and it is happening, working together to try to figure out how can we grow the people that are doing composting in a really caring way. There's the community of composters beyond the Community Composting Coalition of larger composters, the people that come to the U.S. Composting Council, and the people that don't come to the U.S. Composting Council. Composters are, as far as I've met, across the political spectrum, they're really interesting people that do care about things that matter. The largest food scrap composter in Ohio, the owner of that is like 85, and we are polar opposites politically. But he's a cool, wacky old dude who's still like in shockingly great shape, taking 20,000 tons of food scraps a year. It's a different kind of composting with less attention to like quality of composting, in my opinion. But I'm still sure glad he's doing it.
Yeah.
So I think there's something to, there is an older generation of composters like your dad. Organic farming was kind of like coming out of like the hippie movement and was not seen as scientifically rigorous, even though obviously now we all know it surely is. And you had people like John Ferguson in Texas and Carl Hammer in Vermont and Malcolm Beck also in Texas. And some of these folks are now dead. But there are some lessons that I hope we don't lose. And there's a spirit of doing crazy stuff that I also hope we don't lose. Because as things do become more institutionalized, more practiced, trying stuff that is exciting. Anyway,
Yeah, we don't
want to lose. Definitely, I think community composters are apt to try wacky stuff. Because, you know, you meet people that do, like, bokashi followed by vermicomposting, and which seems like an incredibly laborious process to me. How many steps? We already touch our food scraps too many times, but cool. If you're making it work, that's awesome.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the curiosity is there, which is awesome.
Curiosity, yeah.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by AgriLab Technologies. Visit them at agrilabtech.com/podcast. Green Mountain Technologies doesn't believe in one-size-fits-all solutions. We offer cutting-edge engineered composting solutions for large facilities and simple on-site solutions for farms, resorts, and institutions. Our consulting services include odor control solutions, operational planning, and permitting assistance, along with feedstock handling and recipe development. Visit compostingtechnology.com and mention the Composter Podcast for a free consultation.
Okay. This one, I imagine we need like the next like couple hours for. We zoom out for a moment. What does your ideal future look like 5 years from now if things go the way Nathan wants? What does it look like on this planet?
On this planet?
Well, we could talk about Cleveland if we want to just zoom it in a little more.
If anybody's listening in Cleveland, the thing that I want to see in 5 years is the Burke Lakefront Airport shut down and turned into a park. We have this airport that's right on Lake Erie that is only used by very rich people flying in, and it's used for this air show that happens once a year, but it's right on the lake, and it's a total waste of space, in my opinion. So in 5 years, I want to see Burke Airport shut down and a temporary composting site put up on it to build soil for the park that will be there.
Okay.
And I want to see us, Rust Belt Riders, doing 20,000 tons a year of food scraps, working with several other large composting operations, and also identifying other locations we're going to be doing composting. The City of Cleveland Metro Parks talked about the Emerald Necklace of parks around the city. And I like to talk about the Brown Necklace of compost sites around the city. With all of our coprolite gems, coprolite is fossilized poop. So if we're actually going to get to composting something like 200,000 tons of food scraps a year, it's not going to be at a mega site. We're not in an area that has big open expanses 30 minutes out of the city. We're in a pretty densely populated, very sprawled out area. The city of Cleveland's area hasn't changed, but the population of our county hasn't changed much, even though the population of the city of Cleveland has been reduced by 2/3. So the population of about 1.2 million people is in the county, like wall to wall. So finding places outside the county, around the county, where there are in pockets of farmland and other areas is where we're going to find the places to do right by our food scraps and other squandered resources. Next county to the east has a very large horse population. Ohio also is an interesting area because we have a very large Amish population. I think we have the highest population of Amish people in the world, in Ohio, as in a total, like even more than Lancaster, PA, is my understanding. I could be wrong. There's a horse manure problem, and I don't think it's actually the Amish horses that are the issue. It's the hobby horses of wealthier folks that have some land that there's no horse registration. You know, dogs in our county are more regulated than horses in the next county over because, like, you can just have as many horses as you want on any given property, and nobody, there hasn't been a horse census since like 1996. I'd like to see, and also the city of Akron, which is the next city south of Cleveland of size, has their reservoirs in that county. And their reservoirs are being pooped in, essentially, by horses. And I would like to do another one of those jujitsus where you get to flip the bad into the good and, like, let's find a site to build a substantial composting facility and compost 40,000 tons of horse manure and 40,000 tons of food scraps on a big site. Hopeful about that area. So that's a place I'd like to be doing things. I'd like to see us in 5 years not doing any box truck routes except as cleanup routes. We have a stated goal of trying to get to a median income of $60,000 a year in 2017 dollars.
Yeah. Yeah, $2017. All right. Yeah, we've had some inflation since then. Yep.
Right, because we made this goal in 2017 of someday getting to this middle class wage. So those are some of the things I'm thinking about. I'd like to see the community composters and other composters sharing resources and knowledge and maybe even physical assets. Can we have a trommel screen that travels north and south based on the time of year when you need to do screening, if you can do a lot of screening all at once? Things like that.
Okay. Yeah, build that ecosystem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. What else do you want to talk about? What do you want your community of composters to
know? I want to know what boundaries you think need to be pushed. Because you go to a lot of conferences, you've been around the world, you've seen a lot of compost operations. What are the things, where do you want to see things changed?
I'm in a funny place because I'm almost 2 years into permitting to get a new site started. And this is with all the experience in the world, a great team. I'm doing things as efficiently as possible with a lawyer and an engineer and everything. And I think we do need to streamline that process. And it is different state by state. So maybe there's some sort of unifying thing across the country for permitting, or it's different by town, by state, by it's so varied and so complicated to follow. And it seems to be, it's like new everywhere you go. So it should be a little easier to get permitted to do compost. And I think it's going to take some trailblazers to get through it and then help that process be streamlined. I'm just thinking of the roadblocks. I also am very concerned about compost quality declining. This is like a double-edged sword. If there's inexperienced or people that don't have that passion for quality making compost and it's just filled with trash, and then that's what people think of as compost, because it is fairly new to society. I'm just worried about that image of compost actually squashing the industry. That's not what we want. We want people still excited. People are pretty excited about compost right now, and I want that wave to continue. And yeah, I was disheartened when it was 2 years ago, the California conference that we went to for USCC. The sites we visited, there was just a lot of trash. And I don't want to trash talk anybody. My expectation of compost is that there is a minimal of trash as possible. You know, I'm worried about that. I'm worried the depackaging industry is concerning me a little bit, for sure. And it's actually harder for me to get compostable materials now than it was even 5 years ago. And now there's all this legislation that people have to separate food scraps. These are my big concerns. But yeah, there's a lot of things I'm excited about, too. Yeah.
So in states that have food scrap diversion mandates, there's more tonnage, but there's so much trash. There's so much film plastic. There's so much junk. Yeah, and depackaging. So I think you should have somebody that builds depackagers on the show.
I should, actually. I'm putting that down. You've given me so many good ideas for shows, by the way.
But so the depackaging thing is okay. So for people that aren't as familiar, grocery stores and food manufacturers don't want to have to take rotten food or food that's out of spec from a manufacturing standpoint out of the package that they put it in. They just want it to go bye-bye.
Like picture a box of bags of bread.
Yes, pallets of bagged bread.
Yeah, pallets of bags of onions in those mesh bags. Yeah. Yep.
Right. And so depackagers are supposed to get the stuff out of those bags, out of those packages, and separate the compostable parts from the trash parts. And they frequently use screws and presses and extrusion to separate the stuff and slurries. And the depackaging facilities I've been to are totally stinky. And the concern about depackaging is largely around increase in microplastics and various whatever other contaminants. I read BioCycle. I don't read every article in BioCycle. And BioCycle is the trade publication for composters.
It's a great one.
Published by the wonderful Nora Goldstein. But we frequently get articles from Dr. Sally Brown in Washington that are like, hey, what are you guys worried about so much? Is kind of how I take some of her articles. Like if there was one recently about microplastics in compost, or maybe it was PFAS in compost. I think it was actually PFAS in compost, where she argued that there's so much PFAS around that the amount of PFAS in sewage compost, biosolids compost, is just so minimal compared to all the other exposures that in some cases, as people that give a hoot, we're making much ado about nothing. Or rather, not nothing, but much ado about a very small thing versus the much larger sources of pollution. And that's something I wrestle with. I want purity as a lost cause. There is microplastics in baby's blood in utero, which is rather horrifying. And to expect compost to be plastic and PFAS free is a fantasy at this point. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't be working on the upstream issues. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Exactly the same way. I think there's a striving for better quality and to do the best we can to remove that and to, not knowingly, for me, we're not taking in paper products and biosolids and things in our compost. They do need to go somewhere, understanding that, we do have those in our society. The bigger issue is upstream. They're still coming in to the system. At the end of the day, I just have to make good quality compost on my site. That's like I educate and awareness of where these things are coming from. No one needs any more freaking out. Our society is just so full of things to be so nervous about, but to educate and to talk about alternatives and to do the best that we can with that. And keep the science coming. Like, let's keep exploring that. Keep curious. How do we get these microplastics out? How do we get the PFAS out? Like, stop them from coming in is really the thing I want to handle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, can we change the way things are packaged would be great. Like, let's not have toxic packaging to start with.
Totally.
Yeah, if all packages were compostable, legitimately compostable, because, you know, there's questions and maybe they can potentially be a bridge to a reusable world. And how they're sourced and like, are compostable plastics worse environmentally from a life cycle assessment point of view than petroleum plastics? That's something I've never really seen compared, because if you're taking conventional corn and turning that into polylactic acid, then making plastics out of conventionally farmed corn versus a petroleum plastic fork, what's the comparison there on an overall impact in a world where all the packaging is compostable? Great. What if we don't even have to depackage? We just throw the whole darn thing into a compost pile. That would be cool.
It would be. And then I'm on the flip end. I have one of those sites that we don't take in the compostable packaging for our OMRI listing. And I've been glad, like in the past, I'm really glad we took that stance because there's been PFAS coated on those compostable packages and things. So, I mean, in an ideal world, if we're talking about ideal worlds, we have forks that we wash and reuse, and we have plates that we put in the dishwasher and reuse and wash. We've come so far from that, it's hard to see that going back. So being really conscientious about the materials our compostable wares are made from, I think, is the best path forward. This new site, we're slated to have 30,000 tons of food scraps come in, and it's going to be hard to source that without having some packaging, some biodegradable packaging there. So I'm working, I'd like, ideally that's the case, but I'm open to, you know, considering if there's some really great packaging that does come in.
Do you have a different brand name and make it a different product?
Well, we'd have our one site be the OMRI listed site, the one in Rhode Island, and then the other site be the non-OMRI one. I don't know, but a different name seems complicated, but I guess I bridge that when it gets there. But I definitely have the organic versus the non-organic. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's something I think about a lot too. And I mean, we got into potting soil basically because we were making so little compost that we needed to add things to have more product to sell. But we're going to have the flip of that like soon, where we'll have a lot of compost. And so we'll need to be selling a lot more bulk compost, which I am really excited about. And even our site in the city of Cleveland, supposedly there's 6,000 vacant acres in the city, and probably all of them have some degree of contamination. And a little back of the envelope math was telling me that it would take 200 years to put 3 inches of compost on all 6,000 acres coming out of our site.
That must have been a big envelope.
Once you start spreading compost on acreage, it goes away really fast.
Sure does. Yeah. Yeah. So the better the quality, the less you need. Great. Okay. Anything else we should be talking about, Nathan? There's so much.
Well, how should we use compost? And where should it go? And how much should people pay for it?
Just these simple questions. Yeah. So I'll tell you, I am spoiled. I have a 27-acre farm here in Rhode Island, and I use my compost very generously. So at this point, though, it's been almost 50 years of adding compost to the fields. So every fall, I add just about a half an inch to an inch on top of the fields.
What's your bulk density?
It's very dense. Ours weighs about 2,000 pounds a yard. So it's a heavy compost.
So if we're looking at, if we call it an inch on 27 acres, so that's 27, that's 43,560 square feet in an acre times 27 divided by 12, because an inch is 1/12 of an inch, that's 98,000 cubic feet. So you're putting 3,600 yards on your fields every year? That's incredible.
Well, it's 27 acres. It's not all farm field. Some of that's woods. But yes, I mean, generally, yeah, it's quite a bit of yardage that we're using, and it's great. So we have amazing produce here. It's like very easy to grow, and we can have a 9-inch rain event, and the water just soaks right in. It's a beautiful thing.
What's your soil organic matter?
We're
on those farm fields.
It's between 12% and 15%.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. I mean, so I think increasing soil organic matter seems like one of the most obvious uses for compost.
Yeah.
I know it was like the Marin County Carbon Project. My recollection is like something like 23 tons to the acre to raise your soil organic matter by about 1% was a stat I read from them sometime on, of course, Marin County and the Bay Area and whatever their conditions are. But that's something I kind of had in my mind. And so, like, but what is that worth? And who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, exactly.
And this is a question I have because, I mean, trucking is expensive and ought to be expensive and ought to get more expensive, ideally.
Totally. So that's very hyperlocal, but, like, compost tea is amazing. So you can take a cup of compost and make a, for us, I think it's a 5-gallon amount of compost tea that you then add another 5 gallons of water to. So you have 10 gallons to spray. And that's amazing for lawns and for treatments of different molds and mildews around and perennial areas. And you can make a little bit go a real long way. So
I agree. And that is really cool. And I'm also trying to rescue all the food.
I know.
And all the poop. So when we are rescuing all food and poop and tree branches and everything is getting its proper treatment, it's getting cared for.
Yeah.
Where's it going to go?
I mean, we're taking in so much here and it's all going. It's all going. Like, some people getting a bag, some people getting a yard, some people getting 100 yards. It just depends on what you're doing. I think all of it, just like your ecosystem, all the ways needs to be used all the ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm hopeful that we can see some applied municipally for the sake of increasing soil organic matter to reduce. So one of our special challenges here is that we have combined storm and sanitary sewers. So our drinking water comes from Lake Erie, but when it's raining very hard and for a while and the sewer system can't handle it all, raw turds go straight into Lake Erie.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. It's you shouldn't poop where you drink, probably.
No.
And, you know, it's gotten a lot better. You know, there's been federal mandates. And so the sewer district has put in giant holes in the ground, but giant tunnels to store stormwater so that it can be treated so that there are vastly fewer storm sewer overflow events in Cleveland these days. But to me, one of the things that would make a lot of sense would be for the sewer district to be investing in green infrastructure. And this is a whole other, like, interesting discussion, which why is liquid waste regulated and treated so much differently than solid wastes? Why are landfills, I mean, I suppose there are probably some privately operated sewage treatment facilities. I don't know of any in my neck of the woods, but there are a whole lot of privately operated landfills. What's with that? So, like, our sewer district is vast and has massive funding opportunities, whereas our solid waste district is perpetually underfunded and often fearful of even suggesting an increase in the trash fee. And so I think that's a structural issue that I'm really bothered by that is very interesting on, like, a state and, I mean, on a local, state, and national level. And to be curious about how other countries fund their solid waste and if it is more like the way we do sewer districts. Because the sewer districts never seem to have any problem getting $1 billion to make a gigantic investment in public infrastructure. Gosh darn it, waste infrastructure, our solid waste infrastructure, our solid material infrastructure is terrible. And then another issue is, like, the sewer districts are really about treating the materials as wastes that have to be dealt with and not nutrient recovery. Because there aren't that many biosolids composting facilities across the country. You know, here in Cleveland, most of the sewage is incinerated. And so you have this shit ash that they have to do something with. And so that's concentrated heavy metals, et cetera. And they call it a renewable energy facility, which is just preposterous, in my opinion. That's an offensive use of the term, incinerating dewatered sewage sludge. So if it was anaerobically digested, that would be much more plausible as renewable energy. And to all, if they're listening, I don't mean this in any disrespect, because I do. I really like the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District. This is another Dr. Sally Brown thing, where she talks about how most of the nutrients that are lost are in sewage. Like it's not even close. Like, food scraps in landfills is, like, maybe 1/3 compared to the 2/3 that we flush down the toilet. And so if we want to think holistically, I guess this is more toward the far vision thing, is, like, regenerative ag people always talk about farms. They never talk about trash or the whole cycle. And that's a problem. We really have to talk about nutrients from beginning to end to beginning, because we live on a planet which consists of ecological cycles. So when we're all peeing and pooping and flushing that down the toilet after eating our delicious regeneratively raised vegetables and meats and whatever else, that goes somewhere. And right now, there's lots of people really into protein. Protein comes from nitrogen in the atmosphere. All the protein that anybody has ever eaten It was a nitrogen molecule in the atmosphere. And those take a lot of energy to go from nitrogen gas to amino acids. And there's a lot of energy, a huge amount of energy globally used every year on the Haber-Bosch process, which is the way that we make nitrogen to make anhydrous ammonia that is then spread on farm fields, which is then spread on row crops, corn and soy, which is then fed to factory farmed animals, which then people eat. Or the corn goes into our gas tanks, which is another idiotic thing to do. And then meanwhile, you know, we get the highest concentration nitrogen sources for organic farms are factory farm leftovers, which is basically money laundered artificial nitrogen.
Okay, that's it.
Because so chicken shit is allowed in certified organic growing, even if the chicken manure came from non-organic farms. And you know that the rations that those poor chickens were fed was grown conventionally in the cheapest possible way, using probably very aggressive fertility and tillage regimes. And so we are passing Haber-Bosch nitrogen, fossil fuel-derived nitrogen, through tortured animals into organic inputs. And I'm not saying that the organic, you know, the NOP, I think that it's a very reasonable thing to do, given the circumstances. How much nitrogen is the right amount of nitrogen to have in a nitrate or ammonium or protein forms on planet Earth? Currently, we have an unnatural amount of nitrogen around because of the amount of artificial nitrogen. And we are squandering most of it in food scraps in landfills and pee and poop in sewers. And so all that is fossil energy. When nitrate denitrifies and goes back to nitrogen gas, you lose all that energy that went into splitting the nitrogen gas apart and turning it into either a mineral or organic form of nitrogen. And by losing that, that means I just don't know the answer to how much energy could we save? What percent of fossil fuel or nuclear or even renewable, what amount of energy goes toward this artificial synthesis of nitrogen? And if we were effective at recycling our nitrogen, how much of that could just stop?
Yeah, yeah. And nitrogen is a fascinating one. And two parts to that is, like, back to your original thing saying, on a farm like this that we can take that chicken manure from these factory farms that are terrible, we're actually not doing that. There's no factory farms of chickens around Rhode Island that I know of. But then be able to compost it, you're cleansing, right? It's back to that, like, reverence mm-hmm. process. You can take something horrible and sad and turn it into mm-hmm. something amazing. It's a cleansing process. So there's that part. And then there's also the complicated nitrogen cycle. I can't tell you how many people are asked, like, what's the NPK in the compost, you know? And you're like, well, nitrogen's always cycling and we have these little microbes that are breathing and farting. And so it's hard to measure nitrogen in compost. Really, really hard. Do you mm-hmm. get that question a lot too, Nathan?
Yeah. The maximum percent nitrogen in compost is always going to be lower than in straight chicken manure or feather or like distinct animal parts or like, or soy protein isolate.
But it's available. The plants can actually use it. So there's like that part that people are missing that the mark on.
And compost is whole food.
Yeah.
Rather than protein powder.
Totally. Yeah. Or just some pill, really. Yeah. Yeah. So it's not an apples to apples measurement is what I try to say. People just want the easy answer. And I'm like, I can't give it to you. Let's talk for an hour.
Yeah. And I mean, but then also the regenerative ag folks, some of them are like, oh, nitrogen's free. Because if you have a vigorous, like, soil life, then you're going to have enough nitrogen fixation from the plants feeding the microbes that do nitrogen fixation in the soil that the plants don't even need to be fed any extra nitrogen. So then we're still going to have effluent nitrogen from sewage and from food scraps that we still could be doing better by. But of course, there are very few farmers that I've heard of that go to zero additional nitrogen.
What's interesting is, like, I grew up really around the biodynamic gardening community and farming community. And the goal there is closed loop, that you're not bringing any materials in or nothing's leaving the farm, which is hard if you have to sell produce or animals, you have to bring something back in. That's the ultimate goal, you know, is that real closed loop. So that does honor that and capture that. It gets funky because you get people really composting. There's a lot of composting toilets and that sort of thing in the community there.
Oh, good. Because I recall that the founder of Anthroposophy, Steiner.
Steiner.
In his agricultural lectures, he says not to compost, not to use human manures. But he also said, don't take everything I'm saying as this is just the beginning.
It's also like the 20s or something.
Yeah. But this, of course, then reminds me of like Farmers of 40 Centuries, which is a book that anybody interested in composting should read, which is by F.H. King from like 1905, where the Ag Building at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is still named after him.
Wow.
And he was a sort of brilliant agricultural scientist, and he spent something like a year in China, Korea, and Japan looking at the nutrient recycling practices of the people there, and there's photos.
The night soils.
You can find it online. It's incredible. In the introduction, he talks about how the soils of the United States are already degraded in this young nation, whereas in parts of China, there have been, hence Farmers of 40 Centuries, people there in the same spot at a higher population density for 4,000 years, and the soil was in better condition through the fastidious recycling of nitrogen. And of course, it seems like that was very an intensive situation, and being a, you know, being a Chinese peasant at the time was a lot of hard labor. But I think there's still things we could be learning from that.
Totally, totally. We've reached our hour, and I think we've ended on a pretty good note. We had a roller coaster of emotions there. Any last thing you want to say?
Live abundantly.
All right. That's a beautiful ending. Appreciate you so much, Nathan.
Right back at you, Jane.
Big thanks again to Nathan Rutz of Rust Belt Riders for sharing the journey from buckets and bikes to the growing mid-scale compost facility, and for giving us a glimpse into what a compost-centered future could really look like. Nathan's knowledge, vision, and commitment to both cooperative business models and soil health are deeply inspiring, and his storytelling from Cleveland's compost scene to its rich history reminds us that this work is always rooted in place, people, and possibility. Thank you to Galen and Yasna Brown for all sorts of support, Isadora Biggs for being a great assistant, and Pete Hamilton for editing these episodes and making my voice sound so smooth. Don't forget, I'll be back every 2 weeks for 9 more episodes this season to continue our chats with amazing guests, including experienced composters from all across the U.S. and beyond. And if you want to show off your compost pride, check out the new Composter Podcast merch, now available on the EarthCare Farm website. You can follow the show on Instagram at Composter Podcast to stay in the loop between episodes. And thanks so much to our sponsors, AgriLab Technologies at agrilabtech.com/podcast and Green Mountain Technology at compostingtechnology.com. I'm ever grateful to you compost lovers. See you in 2 weeks.